The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 647 for Sunday, March 5th, 2017. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. The show that's like Car Talk, but for Apple geeks. And for those of you who don't know what Car Talk is, kids, ask your parents. No, we come and you send in your questions. We answer your questions. You share your tips. We share your tips. You share your cool stuff found. We share our cool stuff found. The goal is simply for all of us, every single one, you, and yes, me, to learn at least four new things each and every time we get together. Sponsors for this episode include Blue Apron, where at blueapron.com/MGG, you get your first three meals for free. We'll talk about what some of those meals can be a little bit later. And also Text Expander for Teams, because it can help you with your customer service. And as I like to say, every business is the customer service business. You can learn about that at textexpander.com/geek. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
How goes it, Mr. Braun?
Good. Staying warm, staying humidified.
That's good. Staying alive, that kind of thing. Is that what is that what you're trying to say there? Yeah, it's a little bit, been a little cold here in New England. I was down in Florida all week, but now I'm back to the, it was like four last night when I went to sleep. That's not okay. That's very cold. Four Fahrenheit, for those of you that don't always live in Fahrenheit related lands. So yeah, very cold. Very, very cold. But you know, it's all good. We have
how would we, and you know, a quick tip here.
Yeah.
You may ask yourself, how would I convert from Fahrenheit to Celsius? And here's a quick tip here.
I like it.
You can do it from Safari. So I type into the menu bar 4F space equals space question C. And it tells me that 4F is negative 15 degrees Celsius. I think you can also do that with a spotlight.
4F equals question C in Safari's address bar?
Correct.
That just brings up a Google search that shows me 4F minus C total in geochemistry at ACT Labs.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. So you type 4... the letter F space equals space question C.
That's correct.
Well, the result I got. Well, it says in my bar, it says Google search, and it tells me that. Because what you're asking is, okay, 4F equals how many C? And it's smart enough to know.
Oh, I see. So without that, yeah, okay. So, but it's just doing the Google search for that calculation.
Yes, and I think Spotlight, you can do that as well. So conversions are...
Well, actually, no, so Spotlight's different because Safari is literally just doing the Google search for you and finding that calculation. If you simply into Spotlight type 4F, you don't have to type anything else. It says equals negative 15.56 degrees C.
Hey, look at that.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So handy dandy way to convert between almost any unit as long as Google can figure out what you're talking about.
Yeah. Cool. Fine. I like this. This is good. And you're right.
And it's also 257 Kelvin. Hmm.
You know, yeah, you know it's cold when you can start measuring the temperature in Kelvin. I don't actually know what that phrase is supposed to mean because you can always measure the temperature in Kelvin, right? I guess maybe the right way to say it is you know it's cold when you can only measure the temperature in Kelvin. But and I also don't know what that means because you can always measure the temperature in other scales.
Well, I think 0 Kelvin is absolute zero. That's the coldest.
Right.
You can get.
Right. That's right. Yeah. I don't know. These are little sound bites I share with you folks for you to use in your everyday lives. You can either give me credit or not. It depends on whether or not the people that you're with like them. If they do like them, I assume you'll keep credit for yourselves. If they don't, you blame that jerk on the podcast. So there you go. Harvey. Let's see if we can help Harvey here. Harvey writes, have you guys ever heard of this where my menu bar, which is set to always show, hangs occasionally? The clock stops and putting the mouse there at the top of the screen reveals the spinning beach ball. Logging out and back in fixes it, But how can I stop this from happening at all? I'm running 10.12.3 on a late 2012 iMac with 16 gigs of RAM and an SSD. So, Harvey, your menu bar is, and he also sent in a thing saying quitting the Finder didn't help, which makes sense because that portion of the menu bar is run by a process called System UI Server, capital S, capital UIS. So it's capital S, YSTEM, capital UIS, ERVER. That process runs the menu bar, and you can get rid of it by typing kill all space System UI Server in the terminal. So that would be one way to restart it without having to log out and log back in. You won't see it if you do a force quit thing, but you will see it in Activity Monitor. If you don't want to have to go to the terminal, you can quit it from there. And that will reset that. Now, as to why it's freezing in the first place, my first thought is, are you running any third-party menu items that live inside the menu bar proper? And I qualify it that way because some things appear in the menu bar but are not running inside of System UI Server. They're running as their own processes with their own little things that sit up there. And that's how they should be running, to be perfectly honest. So the easiest way to know, and you've got to have quick eyes, is to do that force quit of System UI Server and watch what disappears. Because there may be things that stick around. Those are not running inside of System UI Server. Those are not causing your hangs. So take a look at what does disappear. Maybe you have some older menu bar extension that is living inside System UI Server and is causing it to hang. I remember, back in the day, even things like menu meters, which actually still exists now, but was kind of the predecessor, the preceding competition to iStat menus, and that would live inside that process. And I think maybe even iStat menus now lives inside that System UI Server process. But so take a look, and you might have something that's got a memory leak or something else that's causing issues up there. What do you think, John?
I think I'm with you. It could be that one of the items needs an update. There's a bug or something, or as you said, memory leak.
Yeah. So, right. Yeah, cool. That's what we got then. Moving on to Lou. Lou asks, he says, we cruise quite a bit and take a lot of photos with our iPhones and iPads while traveling. When connected to the ship's Wi-Fi due to limited bandwidth, I prefer my iPhone and iPad to not upload their photos to iCloud. But when I turn off any of the switches in System Preferences or on the iPhone, Settings, iCloud, Photos, I get warnings that all the photos on the device will be deleted. Do you happen to know whether it is possible to pause syncing photos without deleting the photos on our devices? I really wish I had a better answer for you, Lou, because I know you want this. I know I want this. And I know the answer is no. Apple does not provide any granular way of controlling when, or it doesn't provide any way at all of controlling when photos are uploaded to either iCloud Photo Library or PhotoStream. So the only way they will always be uploaded. I say always, that's not entirely true. They will be uploaded when on Wi-Fi and usually also when connected to power, but sometimes not. Sometimes it'll just do it anyway. So I don't have an answer for you. And that kind of sucks. But that's what I have. The only thing I could think of would be to not use iCloud Photo Library and to use something like Google Photos, or if you have Amazon Prime, you could do Amazon Prime Photos, or if you've got a Synology Disk Station, you could use DS Photo and simply not set those to upload while you're on the ship, with Synology's thing, you set geofences where it will upload when you're on Wi-Fi and inside that geofenced area. So obviously don't set it to the ship or any of the ports that you're going to be in. Only set it to, say, home or your office, and then it will do those uploads automatically there. You could always trigger a manual upload in any of those apps, but not in Apple's iCloud Photos. So the answer is don't use PhotoStream or iCloud Photo Library. And I understand what I'm saying by saying that, but that's the answer. Any thoughts on that, John? I would love to find out that I'm missing something. I don't think I am, though.
I always have thoughts. And this one's going to be relevant. The thing is, on the Mac, I think you could do this with a clever application of Little Snitch.
Yes.
So Little Snitch, but I don't believe there's a product that's like Little Snitch for iOS.
No, because so you can't have anything run at that level on iOS, right?
Yeah. So for those that don't know, Little Snitch is basically an outgoing firewall. It will tell you when things are trying to communicate from your Mac to over the network to something outside. And I think you could create a rule saying, all right, Photos is trying to connect to, and it may be AWS, it may be, you know, something else, but you could say, all right, you know, for this time period or this condition, do not allow that connection to be made. But again, I don't think there's a way to do that on iOS. The other thing I'll mention is that, so I use OneDrive, and OneDrive, at least on iOS, or at least the way I have it set up, you have to manually run the application in order to send your camera roll to the cloud, which on the one hand you say, well, that's kind of lame. You know, it should be doing that in the background for you. Sure. Some other programs will do that in the background for you. On the other hand, it's nice because then you maintain control over when your stuff gets sent up to the cloud.
Right.
So
yeah, there's no way to do it on iOS. I guess the way to do it would be to only have your Mac connect to the ship's Wi-Fi, if you bring your Mac with you at all, and then only connect your iPhone to your Mac's Wi-Fi, you know, shared that way. I mean, it starts getting a little weird. And of course, now you can only connect to Wi-Fi from your iPhone if you're within range of your Mac. It's not entirely good, but, you know. Now, there is an app called, this is interesting, there might be a way to do this on iOS, and maybe this app that we're about to mention doesn't do it, but this is interesting. So Andy in the chat room at MacGeekGab.com/stream suggests a piece of software called AdBlock by FutureMind, which is an iOS app that does all of its blocking by creating a pseudo VPN. And by choosing to send all traffic over the VPN, you now can control what gets sent and what doesn't. And so it's built to block ads, but Andy seems to think that it will also block all of iCloud. Now, that's sort of a baby with the bathwater approach here, but it might work. So we'll put a link to AdBlock there. But I'm thinking that, you know, if AdBlock won't do it, it's certainly possible for someone to do this, and maybe the Little Snitch folks could write a little thing for iPhone, or an even better app than Little Snitch at this. Little Snitch will do it, John, and I've used it for that on my laptop for years. But there's a better app. It's called Trip Mode, and it's a Mac app, but perhaps they could follow AdBlock's lead and create one for iPhone. Trip Mode makes doing this way easier on your Mac than it is with Little Snitch, because with Little Snitch you've got to like create all the manual firewall rules and kind of go nuts with it. With Trip Mode, it just sort of works. It has all the rules in it, and you can choose whether internet access is allowed for things like, you know, any apps that you run, or also things like iCloud and Dropbox and, you know, those sort of what I'll call background processes, for lack of a better term. That's at tripmode.ch. So, I like the idea of the VPN controlling it. It makes me think there might be another app to do this that we don't know about here. So hopefully somebody, if it does exist, somebody listening knows about it. So good discussion. I like it. Okay. You want to take us to Michael, John?
One of many, it seems. This is like the Michael episode almost. So I think we have like three Michael questions.
I do, and I think they're all different Michaels, too.
Yeah.
So the first Michael writes in and says he's running into a problem that we'd like an answer or solution to. Well, we'll do what we can. I have a file stuck in my trash, and I've tried to permanently delete it, and it doesn't want to. I go to eject the drive and then it disappears, or the trash can then shows that it's emptied. So, and I kind of skimmed through that the first time I answered the question. And we have talked about this in the past, so I'll offer a few tips here on how you can get rid of something in the trash that does not want to go away. So, one, there is a piece of software, Dave, that's still out there, and it's called, appropriately enough, Trash It. And you can get it at nonamescriptware.com/downloads, and you'll see the product there. And I think it does some stuff, which we're going to talk about shortly, in the terminal that kind of forces the trash to get emptied. So that's one thing to try. Now, here's the second. And so the first time I answer the question in the context of the regular trash. So this is going to require you to go to the terminal, but don't be afraid. We'll guide you through it. So you may wonder, where is the trash located on your system? And I'm going to tell you where it is. And it's kind of sneaky because it's kind of hidden. So what you want to do is, if you go into the terminal, by default, it should open and you should be in your home directory.
Right.
Now, if you do a ls, which lists all the files, you're not going to see anything called trash. Well, that's because it's sneakily hidden. It's actually .trash is the trash directory for your primary drive. So what you could do...
.trash with a capital T, folks.
Yes. So what you can do is go into the terminal, type cd space .trash, and that's the trash directory. And you should see the files that are in the trash for your primary drive. And the remove command is rm space and the name of the file. And you can type the first few characters and hit tab. It should do an auto-completion. Same thing with trash. If you type dot T and then hit the tab, that should CD you to the
again,
trash.
Again, dot capital T, because there is no dot lowercase t trash folder, and it won't bring you anywhere.
Correct. So that's one thing to try. But then he got back to me and said, well, it's on the external drive. And I'm like, oh, duh. You know, I didn't read the question fully. And I think this may do it for him. Now, the thing is, a file on an external drive is not in dot capital T trash. It's in a different location. So you still want to go into the terminal. And then this gets kind of wacky. But you want to CD space slash volumes, capital V, slash the name of the external drive.
And again, typing a few characters and hitting tab will autocomplete that, including dealing with spaces and anything that you might have to deal with.
Right. Then a slash, then dot capital T trashes. All right. That's kind of weird. It's a little different. Then a slash. And then what your user ID is. In my case, I saw 505. I think that's what that signifies. That's the ID of the user that owns that directory.
It is. Yeah. It's easier just to go to CD slash volume slash name of external drive slash dot trashes and hit enter. And then do an LS there and see what user IDs are listed. That might make it easier than trying to, you know, guess while you're typing the command.
And that's actually what I did. When I went into trashes, I saw 505. It was the only directory there. So I'm like, okay. And I went in there and then I saw the file that was in my external drive's trash.
Yep.
And then the same thing, do an RM space. And I don't even think you have to do a sudo. I don't think you may have to do a sudo, but
this is another one of those that's going to be good for you to publish as an MGG answers, John, because all this terminal stuff.
Oh, there's a lot of typing.
There's a lot of typing.
You're going to ruin everything.
I want to point out, as we've been doing this here, I've been assisted greatly by the shell that I choose to use on my Macs. I don't use any of the stock shells in the terminal. So for those of you that are interested in the terminal and use it a lot, I use a shell called the Fish Shell, which is at fishshell.com. Easy for me to say. And it does a lot of great things, like if I type, CD space dot T, lowercase t, it knows there's no folder in where, you know, where, or no directory where I am with a lowercase t. So it automatically not only changes it to an uppercase t, but offers to fill in the remainder of that word. So it says dot capital T trash. And it's a really, really great shell to use. Makes the autocomplete stuff super easy. You can choose things with your arrows. If you're doing aliases in the terminal or anything like that, you get a much more robust way of controlling those with functions as opposed to aliases. And they're really easy to do. And the best part is it's easy to install, because if you're using Homebrew, you simply type brew install fish and it installs fish and gives you the instructions that you need after it's finished installing, of course, to make it your default shell on your Mac. So highly, highly recommended for fish shell. So,
and one more tip, I think we've already learned 5 things.
Yeah.
If not more. Say you want to change your shell to another of the ones that are built into the OS. Well, there's a command for that. If you go into the terminal, and I think this is still valid, though I haven't had to use it in a while, but if you type CHSH, mm-hmm. which I'm going to guess stands for change shell, it's first going to ask for your admin password, and then you're going to see, at least on this one machine, it actually opens up an editor. And one of the lines in here is, oh, well, this is your shell. And they're located in the bin directory. So bash, again, I think is the default, but there are some others. If you look in the bin directory, you should be able, I think there's ZSH, there's SH, there's CSH, there's anything that ends in SH, I think it's pretty safe to say it's it's a shell. I mean, you can find out by just running it.
Sure.
And seeing if it changes the shell. You can do this, though, you know, just to see if you like a different shell. Just run it. I think you'll have to go to bin bash. I think you have to type a period in order to execute it, or you may not.
To run a shell? No, just type the name of the shell. If you want to run bash, type bash.
Because bin is your path, so you should be able.
Just type bash or you know, ZSH is one that that a lot of people in the chat room are telling me they like, especially, and ZSH is built into your Mac, but they like it, especially with something, a little helper called Oh My ZSH, which is at ohmyz.sh, and so we'll put a link to that in the show notes too, so that you folks can check that out. So fun stuff with the terminal. I like it. I like getting a little geeky.
I think there's one last thing you can do, though. I don't think this. There's another type of empty trash that you can do.
Yeah.
So if you go to the Finder menu, now I don't think this. But if you go to the Finder and you hold down Option. Well, first, if you go to the Finder menu and there's something in the trash, there's an empty trash selection. Now, mine is grayed out because I don't have anything in the trash, and I'm not going to do this now, at least on the podcast machine. But there's empty trash, and I think if you hold down Alt, I think you get a different version of emptying the trash, and that may work. Is it like Secure Empty or something like that? It's a different version of the...
Yeah.
It's a different way of emptying the trash. That's another thing you can try, is that may... throw something out
if regular
empty trash does not.
Yep. Yeah. Fun stuff. Cool. Hey, you know, while we're on the subject of shells and the terminal and all that, I want to talk briefly about the Amazon AWS outage that happened this week, because it happened because someone, an engineer at Amazon, you know, they have all their servers are load balanced. And one of the engineers wanted to take a few of their servers offline because something was happening with those that was causing the rest of things to slow down. So, you know, he or she, I don't know who it was, but he or she was going to take these servers offline, do whatever needed to happen to them to, you know, get them back in business and then put those servers back online. And this engineer fat fingered the command, and instead of taking just, you know, a few servers offline, took many, many, many servers offline. And this can happen, right? I mean, I've totally experienced this. And what I've done in the past, unintentionally, as happened with this engineer, is I've rebooted the wrong machine. I use the terminal all the time here. Every terminal session on my Mac on the surface looks the same because they all have the same foreground and background colors and all of that stuff. So it's not immediately obvious to me if I'm logged into, say, the iMac downstairs or the server that runs TMO in Virginia. And once, thankfully it's only happened once, I issued a restart for the computer downstairs. And hey, guess what? The computer in Virginia started restarting. The only way to mitigate against that is to like do some customizations of your shell so that you can like see different colors there. Or at this point in time, I happen to be already sudoed up as root on this machine down in Virginia. So what I'm about to say wouldn't help. But if I wasn't and I was just going to type, say, sudo space shutdown space dash R space now, which says shut it down, but really and then restart and do it now. But by typing sudo before it, it's because I have to type my root or my password to authenticate as root. I know this goes without saying, and I know none of us would ever do this, but make sure you have your passwords different between those servers. So if you think you're in, you know, telling the computer downstairs to reboot, you'll type at the very least, you'll type its password and it'll say wrong. And then you'll be like, oh, yeah, that's right. I'm not logged into that computer. But yeah, that's what happened with Amazon this week. And it can happen to anybody. I've totally experienced it, you know. Interesting.
Human error. You just got humans out of the equation.
Error between the chair and the keyboard. That's right.
Or operator error, as we call it.
Yeah. 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 It happens. All right. You want to change gears and talk about the next Michael? And it is. It's three different Michaels that you picked this week, John. But you want to talk about the next Michael and
yes.
Perhaps a little router thing here?
All right, and sweet. Michael has a
actually,
great
you know what?
Question.
You know what? Before we do that, because I'm going to talk through the sponsor block and then I'm going to give my voice yet another rest and I'm going to let you talk about Michael after we talk about our sponsors here. Our first sponsor, as I mentioned, is Text Expander. With Text Expander for Teams, Text Expander is a tool that you've heard me talk about countless times. It's one of those things I desperately need on every Mac that I use because it allows me to have little snippets of text that I can invoke with shortcuts. One of the best parts about that is that I know what I'm typing isn't going to be screwed up by me typing it because I'm pulling it from the snippet, right? And so I type my little shortcut and the text comes out. Now think about that in the context of a team, right? When you're running customer service, you want to make sure that what's being sent to your customers, like if there's, if you're going to do a return or if you're going to thank them for your business or anything like that, you want to make sure there's no typos in there. You want to make sure that it's said the way you want your company to say it. And let's be fair, you might have some people, in fact, I guarantee you, you've got some people at your company that are better at writing than others. So why not have the people that are very good at writing write the at least stock things that you send to your customers for everyone? And with Text Expander for Teams, not only can they do that, but you can share this snippet library in a way that if you want to make a change to one of those things that you're sending to your customers, well, it's now automatically propagated to everyone on your team. As long as they're using the same shortcut, everybody gets the updated current version of whatever snippets you're going to use. Everything's immediately accessible. It's all searchable. And again, you just use simple abbreviations. And now it's available on Mac, iOS, and Windows. So it doesn't matter what computers people are using to do this, they have access to it in real time everywhere. Text Expander helps your customer service provide or your team provide better, faster, and more accurate customer service. It's great stuff. Teams of all sizes can leverage this, right? Obviously, the folks at Smile use this. The folks at 1Password use this. The folks at WordPress, Shopify, You Need a Budget, they all use this. So visit textexpander.com/geek and you can start learning and using it too. Great stuff. Our second sponsor is Blue Apron, where at blueapron.com/MGG. You got to use the /MGG. Otherwise, what I'm about to tell you won't work. If you go to blueapron.com/MGG, you will get your first three meals for free. Blue Apron sends you all the ingredients you need and a how-to sheet to make the meal that you have chosen. So you're doing this with all fresh ingredients. It's really tasty. You get to actually cook it. This isn't just like, you know, peel off the you know, the wrapper and put it in the microwave. No. You are cooking these meals, but they're all very efficient. They all take like 20 or 30 minutes. That's it. It's fun to do as a family or a group together. And they've got meals for two people or four people. You can do a family plan, whatever you want. Some of the recipes: pasta and arrabbiata sauce. That's coming up. Tasty stuff. Miso butter chicken. Yeah, I know. Pork and cabbage tacos. Right? Vegetables, chili, and baked sweet potatoes. This is some tasty stuff that they're doing here. Really cool things. Crispy cod sandwiches with salsa verde, right? Chicken meatballs and frigola sarda. Like, this is tasty stuff. Green garlic pesto pasta. I mean, come on. You know, this is stuff that you're going to enjoy eating in addition to enjoying the cooking. And that's how it works. What's cool about Blue Apron is that they've got partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. So the seafood is all sourced sustainably under standards developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. The beef, chicken, and pork all come from responsibly raised animals. The produce is sourced from farms that all practice regenerative farming. And Blue Apron can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S. It's really, really great stuff. So you got to check it out. Go to blueapron.com/MGG and sign up. You'll get your first three meals for free. Meals generally are about $10 or less per person. So for good fresh ingredients for a good dinner. And this is not just your entree. It's like you've got the full meal there. Like I said, when we do it on the family plan, it comes out to somewhere between like $8.50 and $9.50 a person kind of thing. That's relatively inexpensive compared to, you know, even what you're going to get going to the grocery store, ship for free. You got to check this out. So go to blueapron.com/MGG. Coupon code is not necessary. It's right there. It's just blueapron.com/MGG. And you get your first three meals for free and you're going to enjoy it. You're going to have fun. It's tasty stuff. Thanks to both Blue Apron and The Smile with Text Expander for Teams for sponsoring this episode. All right, John, now take me to Michael, please.
I will take us all to Michael. And Michael's going to take us to an interesting place, or it's specific, but it's general.
Okay.
I'm going to make it general, although he has a specific question. So a specific question is about Eero. And he says, I have a printer hooked to my current first generation time capsule.
Okay.
So first thing, I'd be like, you may want to ditch that. Though you don't have to, because I understand why he wants to keep it. So he has a first generation time capsule. And time capsule, it's a router, has a drive in there to do your backups.
Sure.
And he's also using it to share a printer. So he has a printer plugged into the USB port on the time capsule. And what that does for you is it makes your printer available on the network. I think it advertises it using Bonjour. So if you're on another machine on the network and you say, hey, add a printer, it'll be like, oh, yep, here it is. That's a nice feature. You may not want to give that up.
Sure.
And he doesn't. So he said he'd like to continue using it both for the time capsule and the print sharing capabilities. But if he wants to get an Eero, what do you do? Because as I said, my recommendation is you may not want to be using that time capsule.
Sure.
Wi-Fi. And it sounds like he's thinking about getting an Eero. So how do you get the two to coexist?
And how do you get the two to coexist, John?
Oh, and he mentions he has a Comcast Aeris thing.
Okay.
But how do you get this to happen? And I'm going to give the very general answer. Now, the thing is, I did something very similar, is that when I was having an operator error trying to set up the Eero, I was like, you know what? There's something weird here. And I eventually figured out what I was doing wrong. But I was using my TP-Link Archer C9. For the routing capability and using the Eero's Wi-Fi.
Okay.
And so how do you accomplish this in a general sense? And I'll tell you how you accomplish this in a general sense. Now, the thing is, you can go either way here. So you could continue to use one or the other device as your router. But the important part of this is you do not, absolutely do not want to have two devices on your network that are both acting as routers, because that leads to chaos. It's just bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could do it, but you're going to.
Yeah. Eventually it'll work fine. But you will have scenarios where it's a double NAT scenario where you've got two things acting as a router kind of hanging off of each other. And you'll run into scenarios or issues with that at times that will be unexplained if you forget that you've got it set up that way. So
right.
It's better not to have two things running as a router if you can avoid it.
And the thing is, typically a lot of traffic has trouble transversing a double NAT scenario. So you just don't want that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go one of two ways here. So in general, what you're going to want to do is take your cable modem and plug it into the WAN port of the device that you want to act as the router. Now, in the case of the Eero, it's a smarty pants, so you can plug it into either Ethernet port on the Eero.
Right, and it'll figure it out. That's right.
On the time capsule and on my TP-Link, there actually is a dedicated WAN port. So what you want to do is decide which thing you want to act as your router, plug the cable modem into that, and then plug the other device whose services that you want to use. So let's pretend we want to use, like in my case, the Eero is the router. And let's say I had a time capsule with the printer sharing, and I wanted to take advantage of its abilities. This is the important part. You want to put that device into what's called bridge mode. And any device that I've seen that can act as a router, you can also put it in bridge mode. And it basically says, don't act as a router. Just be transparent. Just be part of the network.
That makes sense.
And he says, so, you know, could I get an Eero and could I plug my time capsule into the Eero? And the thing is, yes, you could. My preference would be that you get a switch, unless you only have one other, hardwired device, in which case, yeah, I don't see why that wouldn't work. So you set up the Eero as your router, you plug your cable modem into one port, and then you plug the time capsule into the other port, and then you're going to want to configure the time capsule, turn off its Wi-Fi, and put it in bridge mode. And you should be able to share your printer and do the time capsule stuff as you did before.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I mean, we're talking about Eero specifically here, I totally get why you might want to. It's certainly in this case, you're going to want the Eero as the router and as your, obviously, your Wi-Fi mesh, and then you've got a reason to use the time capsule because you can hang this printer off it with USB. It totally makes sense. You might want to set up your, and we have a lot of people doing this, which is like totally decadent because they're taking my two favorite existing router techs and blending them together, running the Synology 2600 AC as their router because they like all the configuration options. And trust me, I get it. And then using the Eero in bridge mode to run their wireless mesh, which, again, is just totally decadent. Eero's dropped their price by $100, so that helps. But still, awesome. But lots of you are doing it. I kind of want to do it, but I've got my Eero set up at my dad's house now so that I can test the full, running it as a router mode. The Eero will work in bridge mode, right? But not every one of the mesh options out there will. And I'm doing this off the top of my head. So Eero will work in bridge mode. Ubiquiti's Amplify will work in bridge mode. The Orbi will work in bridge mode. The new Linksys Velop will work in bridge mode. However, there's no way in the main UI to do that. You have to log into the super secret web UI to set it to bridge mode. And then it totally works fine. And there's some talk of that super secret web UI being made a whole lot less super secret, because it's an awesome UI. It's way better than the app is actually pretty good, but it's better than that. So the firmware update might fix that. But that will do it. Google Wi-Fi specifically will not operate in bridge mode unless you are only using one Google Wi-Fi device. So which effectively precludes it from being used as a mesh. If you are using multiple Google Wi-Fis to create your wireless mesh, it will not let you put it into bridge mode. This, of course, doesn't make sense. Google sort of their PR people acknowledge this and are intelligent about it. I don't want to say that Google's acting ridiculously, but their forward facing sort of customer messaging page says you lose all of the meshing features if you put it in bridge mode. We know that's not true because I just listed a bunch of meshing things that work great as a mesh without being in router mode. And Google knows this too. They may offer a software update that allows bridging down the road, but currently Google Wi-Fi does not. So, and I think, let's see, Luma will not work in bridge mode to my knowledge. And I think I've covered them all. So there you go. Just be careful. Google Wi-Fi and I believe Luma will not work as just a bridged mesh, but the rest of them will. And I've actually been running lots of them this way to test them. The Linksys Velop and the Ubiquiti Amplify in bridge mode. So, and now Ubiquiti. I just started testing this yesterday. Ubiquiti does a cool thing, John. If I might continue to hijack this question from you here, but they now have their Amplify HD mesh points for sale. I believe they're for sale. They're going to be. They exist. They shipped me one to test. I'm using it. It works great. It's a standalone mesh point, so you can associate it with your existing router. So I associated it with my Synology RT2600 AC. You can buy multiples. You can make a mesh out of whatever router you want to use, right? So in your case, John, I mean, I know you're happy with Eero, and that's great. But if you didn't have Eero, then you had your TP-Link, but you wanted to do some meshing, you could get one or two of these Ubiquiti 8 Amplify HD mesh points, standalone mesh points, and associate them with your network. It effectively is a very, very smart, wireless repeater extender setup, but it's all using the same SSID. It's all doing things as intelligently as possible, given that, the way it works. And it will do multi-hop if you need to do that, but it's also smart enough to know that multi-hop is generally not the most efficient thing if it's possible for everything to talk back to the main router. So it's pretty cool what they've done with this. So we'll put a link to those. Hopefully it exists, and hopefully I'm not spilling the beans too soon. But sure. I don't think I am. It hasn't been like – all the emails I've gotten haven't had like embargo all over them. So at least not anymore. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's cool. Very, very, very cool. So
finally,
yes, John.
Now to get back to printer sharing. So I want to share this with others because I ran into some issues when I wanted to share my printer. So like Michael, I shared my USB. It's a HP inkjet. That's a USB printer. And when I had the time capsule, I would plug it in and share it that way. Well, once I ditched my time capsule, I had to find another way to do that. And you may ask yourself, what are the other ways of sharing a USB printer? Well, one was the TP-Link actually has a USB port on it. And they did offer, though I don't think they've updated it, and then they offered a special driver that you had to install that would allow computers to map the printer plugged into the TP-Link from another computer.
Sure.
Like I said, they, because of... I don't know. I think the driver was not signed. There are issues running it on the most recent OS, and I haven't looked if they've updated that. I hope that they do, because that was a nice feature. That was one of the selling features of getting that, is that you could either plug a hard drive into it or a printer and share it, similar to the time capsule. The Eero does have a USB port on it, but as far as we know, Dave, its purpose is to be there.
Yeah, maintenance only. And in other words,
I don't know what would happen if you plugged a printer in there, but I'm sure I don't think it'll destroy it, but I don't think it's going to share it, which would be nice. And maybe they'll add that someday.
Right.
That would be swell. Another option for sharing a printer, and this is what I'm currently doing right now, is I have it plugged into my Mac Mini. So you plug it in, uses the driver on the Mac Mini, and then you go into System Preferences, Sharing, and I think I enable Print Sharing. And that will make that printer available to other machines on the network. Finally, another thing which I toyed with, but it wasn't quite for me because the driver that they use wasn't that great, you can actually use many Synology devices to share a printer.
And that's this works true.
The thing is, I didn't go for that option because the driver that they used wasn't a good match for this printer. This is kind of a weird printer in that it can print up to 13 by 19 inches.
Sure.
And whatever driver they used it didn't quite grok that concept. So if I tried to print on anything larger than 8.5 by 11, it didn't get it quite right. And they may have fixed that. They just released a new version of DSM. So, right? 6.1 is out now. Hooray.
Yeah, right.
So, but a Synology is another way that you can share printers, USB printers.
Yep.
So sharing is good. So those are, I think, all the options that I know of for sharing a printer.
Yeah. There's
one that's USB only. We had someone in the chat room point out that a lot of printers now have USB in them, and I guess you can buy
have Wi-Fi in them, you mean? Yeah.
Or I'm sorry. Yes. Have Wi-Fi and you can then make it part of your network and then it'll broadcast itself in a similar fashion. You can then access it from any other computer because it has Wi-Fi and it joins the network and says, right. Hi, I'm a printer.
Yeah. Yeah. And isn't there, I'm trying to remember if the, if Lantronix still makes their X-Print server.
Oh, gosh.
Right. But yeah, I don't.
That was all the rage a while ago. It was a device that, yes, it let you share a USB printer via Wi-Fi. Yeah.
Or onto your network. It was an Ethernet thing that you plugged in and then it. Yeah. I mean, it obviously connected to your existing Wi-Fi if your Wi-Fi was connected to your Ethernet, which it always is. So, I think the X-Print Server Office, which they call Enterprise Mobile Printing. But this is the device. And it looks like it is available from Lantronix still. You can sell it. You can't sell it. You'd have to talk to Lantronix about that. But you can order it. It's not cheap though. I think it's like $250. So maybe I'm missing the consumer version of this. But we'll put it in the show notes and then we'll notify Lantronix of this discussion. We'll find out about the. We'll see if there's a version that is more acceptable price-wise to the consumer because there used to be,
Seeing a few options here.
Are
I
you?
Just typed in Lantronix print server and yeah. Google brought up, it brought up, which I think you found the current product, $199.95, which
okay.
I think is a bit steep for many people
yeah.
to share your printer. But then I also see... It looks like somebody on eBay is selling one of their first generation, and that's $59. And then I see XPrint Server Cloud Edition for $149.
Yeah.
So anyways, Lantronix makes print serving solutions.
Yeah.
And we have used them in the past.
Yeah, I've got one here. But yeah, that seems like you said, $200 seems a little pricey. You could probably buy a new printer that has Wi-Fi capability for a lot less than that. Yeah. So anyway, there we go. Fun stuff. One thing, I know we're jumping all over the place here, but it's what we do to jump back to the Ubiquiti standalone Amplify HD mesh points. They are available. They're $129 each. And they are these mesh points that are the same as the mesh points that came with the, I believe they're exactly the same. The model number says they're the same. I don't believe there's any engineering difference, but they certainly look the same as those that come with sort of the Amplify full mesh system with the router and everything in that they have no Ethernet port on them. These are the things that plug only into an outlet. They hang off of the outlet. If your outlets are ground up, then the antennas point down because that's how these things are. And I think all building code now in the U.S. says that outlets need to be ground up. So that's a little weird. And there's no Ethernet port on them. So if you have Ethernet in your walls and you want to use that, which is much better, of course, to build your mesh, there are different different Ubiquiti products that you can get, but the Amplify Mesh HD points wouldn't be what you want to use for that. But for simply putting, a couple of mesh points around your house, it's a cool little solution. So anyway, let's move on and change gears entirely. Let's go to Brett here, because Brett's got, Brett's got a problem. He says, I have 7 different email accounts and each has several aliases. When I create a new mail message, mail autofills a return email address from my alias list. Sometimes when I'm in a hurry, I forget to check and send the email using the wrong alias. Is there a way to set up mail to always require me to select a return address when I create a new message? It works fine when replying to an existing message, but not a new one. So I have some thoughts on this. If you go to Mail Preferences and Composing, you can see there that you can either choose a specific email address to send all mail from, or you can say automatically select the best account. Automatically select the best account is what most of us would use in this scenario. And it will do, it will choose based on a couple of factors. If you're replying to an email, it will just reply from the address to which the email was sent. So that's actually almost certainly what you want. If you are composing a brand new email, it will try to be intelligent about it based on what mailbox you're in, what message you currently have selected. It seems like sometimes there are other factors involved, but that's what it does. So, and I can totally get where if you're not paying close attention, you would wind up sending a message without choosing the right from address. I live in this world. I've done it, but I've been doing it long enough that I think my habits are such that I never send an email without first stopping to look at that as part of kind of my pre-send check. If you don't want to have to wait until your habits have developed, though, and I totally get that, one way to do it would be to create a separate mail account that you don't check and you don't store a password for, and the from address is something that you cannot send mail from. And that way, if you don't change it and set that in the, mail preferences composing as the always send from this address. And that way, if you don't change it and you hit send, it's going to pop up and say, what's the password for this account? I can't send mail from this account. And it'll sort of get you, it won't send the message because it literally cannot, because it doesn't have the right mail server or password or credentials or anything for this, kind of dummy mail account. So that would be one way to sort of put the stops in to force you to select an outbound address. I don't know of any either built-in or extension/plugin way of having mail prompt you as you go to send, but I don't know about everything that's available for mail. And frankly, I don't even know about all the features in the plugins that I do use. So it's entirely possible somebody will say, hey, dude, Mail Acton will do this. And I'll say, hey, no kidding. So if somebody does want to say, hey, dude, or hey, Dave, or whatever you want to call me, it's fine. Send a message to us at feedback@macgeekgab.com and we'll go from there. But those are my thoughts on that, John. What do you think?
My thoughts are your thoughts in this case. Is that that's how I'm set up?
Yep. Yep.
It almost always gets it right.
I will say that you're right. And the other day, I was looking at MacGeekGab email, and I wanted to forward a message actually to you because you put together a great thing that I thought would be an awesome MacGeekGab answers, because it involves some terminal stuff and things like that, that would be better in print than spoken here on the podcast. So I wanted to forward this to you. So I hit, the keyboard shortcut for forward. I typed in your address, and at that point, the from address changed from what I just said, feedback@macgeekgab.com, to dave@macobserver.com, because that's the message. That's the address that I usually send to you from. So I found that very interesting, because I went to change it and was like, Oh, it's already changed. How did it know? So I don't know. I might have done something to cause it to change, but it did it. I don't remember doing it. And again, you know, I just came back from a trip. I've been tired. And so, you know, I'm not, who knows?
Nice. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that you mentioned an email address, Dave. I'm pretty sure the email address that you just said is feedback@macgeekab.com.
Well, I said it twice, so I hope I got it right. The only thing that I will point out is that many of you, in fact, I would say most of the people that we've talked about in this show, and I think possibly all the remainders, but I might be wrong about that, are premium subscribers. And so premium@macgeekab.com is the address that all of these people have used to send us their messages. And to be perfectly honest, this week, the premium address is the only one I was able to get through everything with because my schedule was tight coming back from this trip. I was exhausted and we almost didn't get to do the show today. But thankfully, there was enough in the premium box to get through the show. The rest of you that aren't premium members, I will get to it. We will get to it within the next week here. But the premium address does get prioritized. We always say that and we mean it because we do it. So if you're interested in supporting us, please visit MacGeekab.com/premium or simply MacGeekab.com. There's instructions there on how to support us directly. We would very, very much appreciate it. It helps more than you could possibly imagine, although perhaps you can imagine enough. So thank you for everyone that's a premium subscriber, including all the folks that we've talked about here, including Brett. So hopefully we helped Brett with that. And now premium listener Robin has a question about mounting network drives full time. Robin writes, I got to get past all my crazy screenshots here. I have a geeky question, which is good because this episode has turned out to be a pretty geeky one. I have a MacBook Pro 13-inch, which currently has a 2 terabyte external drive attached for my media files, iTunes, photos, etc. I'm thinking of moving this to one of my more robust storage mediums. I have 2 options and 1 advice upon which route will provide the best and most reliable service. I have a 4-bay Synology disk station, which is option 1, and I also have a 5-bay Drobo 5D attached to my Mac Mini running OS X or Mac OS server package. Which of these should I host my files on, and how do I make sure that they auto mount and are always available when I am at home? This is a good question. Either one of those options is going to suffice. The Drobo is obviously a direct attached unit. It's not network attached, but it is network attached in that you have it connected to an always on Mac Mini running as a server. So from that standpoint, it's totally fine. It's always on. The Synology disk station is obviously directly attached to your network. It's on all the time. So in terms of storing files, the two are very equal in that regard. They both will store files, and the way you have them set up, they both are available full time on the network. So pick whichever one of those you want to use. And then the way I do this is twofold. I need to make sure that drives are mounted when I start up my machine, so when I log in, and also when my computer wakes up from sleep. So to do the first one, I created an automator action that auto mounts or that mounts the shares that I have that I on my network here at the house and office that I want to have up on my Mac all the time. I have 3 of them, but you know, you might just have 1 and that's fine. You do an automator action called get specified servers, and then you just put in the server addresses there. You can use SMB or AFP, just, you know, go and get that from your network connections and paste it in there. You can even just add it in and then use the automator action connect to servers. And that will take the input from get specified servers, which is what we just did, and connect. Prior to that, I actually have it get specified finder items, and I go into the volumes folder and choose the I call my thing like volume/ds-general, which is my disk station general storage. I have it get that and then eject that disk. I make sure it's cleared that out before I start mounting the servers again, just in case it wants to double up. But get specified servers and connect to servers are the two automator actions that I link together. And then I save that on my Mac as an application. You can save automator scripts, for lack of a better term, as applications so that they can run standalone. This is important because you're going to want to run this as a standalone app. So once I've done that, I put the standalone app in my login items and it mounts my servers when I start up my Mac. So that's a win. Right up until my Mac goes to sleep and then wakes up from sleep and it's not there. For that, I use Control Plane. Control Plane is a very, very cool little piece of software at controlplaneapp.com that allows you to script or trigger actions based on what they call contexts. Contexts are then decided by evidence sources. And one of the evidence sources that you can choose is sleep-wake status. So I set an evidence source of wake up, and I run exactly the same action, this little app, when my Mac wakes up. And even better, I sync that little action you could do it with Dropbox. I do it with Synology Cloud Station, but you could do it with iCloud Drive. I sync that action to all of my Macs in the house here so that if I ever make a change to it, everybody gets the same thing. So now when my Mac wakes up, it does the same thing. It remounts those drives and everybody is happy. And I don't have to think about it. The drives are always mounted for me all the time. So that's what I do. John, any thoughts?
I kick it old school and I manually mount my network shares when I need to, and then unmount them when I'm done with them.
Yeah.
That's what I do. And if I put the machine to sleep, you'll often get this message. So if I put the machine to sleep and wake it up, sometimes you'll get this message. I think it says network connection interrupted or something similar.
Yep.
And then it's like, yep, hold on. I'm talking to this network share. You'll be able to use it in a moment. And then with USB drives, again, I plug them in, do what I need, and then unmount them. Or on my one machine, I have a carbon copy cloner do it for me.
Right. Well, so, okay. So that's sort of the corollary to this is when with carbon copy cloner, I clone to a clone drive every day. Carbon copy cloner, when it finishes doing that clone, it ejects the disk for me, which is good. You don't want your clones online because they'll take over the world. No, that's different. Because you don't want to accidentally be launching apps or files or anything from your clone. And since it's a clone, it all has the same name. It's hard to know the difference. When you start up your Mac, though, your clone will mount. So you either have to remember every time your Mac starts up to eject your clone or write an automator action that ejects your clone and save it again as an app and put it into your login items so that when your Mac starts up, it also runs that. It ejects your clone. You're good to go. So that's the other flip side of it. And it's for this reason that I hope Automator stays around. But, we shall see, right? Fun stuff. Okay, Phil. We're going to let Phil ask his question. And Phil's gonna tell us who Phil is.
Hello, boys. It's Phil here from Scared. Yes, the Scared Podcast, available now on iTunes, Google Play, and at scaredpodcast.com.
Are you afraid of the dark? You will be. This is the Scared Podcast.
Anyway, as we get ready to launch a second show, a sister show called Extra Scared, a look at the week's paranormal news, I'm a bit lost because I need something. I need an app where I can dump in links and text and photos and maybe videos. Now, at the moment, I'm using Pocket to save the article, but I'd love an app where I can just, as I said, dump text and videos and photos and all that sort of stuff that I can use later. Now, I'm sure on MacGeekGab you've talked about such an app where you can store stuff like an online filing cabinet. So that's my question. What was that app? Or do you know of some sort of app? So this is Phil from scarepodcast.com. Nice plug. Thanks for what you do. This is where you can cut me off.
Scaredpodcast.com.
I think that's a good place to cut Phil off. Yeah.
Well, okay. That's what you think.
You might argue that it was earlier in the process, John.
It was entertaining.
Yeah, it's entertaining. This one time. That's this one time. That's right.
Just don't do it again.
Yep. So what we use here is Evernote. And Evernote allows us to do exactly that, all of that. And in fact, I played Phil's, without even thinking about it, I played Phil's audio comment from Evernote. I took it when it came in. I put it into Evernote. I named it, you know, Phil asking a question about an online filing cabinet. And the nice part was I don't even remember what computer I did that on, but it synced here via my Evernote account to this computer. It also synced, because we share this library, to your Evernote account, and you have it in your Evernote as well. Evernote runs on all platforms, Mac, Android, iOS, Windows, doesn't matter. You can even see it on the web, and you can store links, you can store files, you can store text, and it works great. So there you go. But you could also use Apple Notes to do a lot, if not all of this. Well, you could do a lot of it. What Apple Notes won't do is allow us to share an entire notebook in a collaborative way yet. It will allow us to share notes, individual notes, in a collaborative way. That's not enough for what you and I need to do, John. But for Phil, Apple Notes might be enough. So that's or, you know, Microsoft's OneNote, I hear great things about. I've also heard about a new thing called, I think it's about a year old, called Bear. And I don't know enough about it, but it's at bear-writer.com, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, we love bears.
Well,
oh, actually, no. Not in person.
No, no.
But tunnel bears. I like tunnel bear.
That's totally different.
I know.
Okay. So but yeah, Evernote will do it for you.
Only thing I'll mention with Evernote, and I'm within their, so they had they got cheapskates like me kind of upset the other, a little while ago. The thing is you can only run two copies under your account before they want you to throw them some coin.
Yeah, but it's relatively cheap, right? I think I'm.
But I work with it. The thing is, I run it on my Mini and I run it on my MacBook Pro, and I really don't feel a need to run it on my phone. So okay. I don't.
Yeah, right.
So I'm within their free program limits.
Yep.
But as an individual, yeah, just keep that in mind. If
right.
You know, you're collaborating with a lot of people, then you know, a small fee may be involved for Evernote.
Yeah, I pay for the Evernote premium thing, which is $70 a year. I really only need, I think I would only need Evernote Plus, which is $35 a year. But I choose to pay for the premium because it lets me search for text inside of PDFs, which is a handy thing for me to be able to do. I can also edit PDFs inside it, which I never really do anymore, but that it allows to, you know, annotation and all that stuff too. But we do a lot with PDFs here. What John and I do when we answer an email is we actually, before we send it to you, we save it as a PDF. In fact, we use an automator action to save that PDF, title it, and then stuff it into our specific Evernote kind of queue, Mac Geek Gab queue, in which we sync back and forth. And then from there, we move these things around. So they are PDFs. And so that's why I wind up paying for the premium one, just so I have the flexibility to do stuff there. But yeah, and I'll say that Microsoft's OneNote, if we weren't already using Evernote, John, I think I probably would have chosen Microsoft's OneNote for our stuff here, because it's a really great thing. The app is fantastic. Works great on the Mac, on iOS, all good stuff. I should point out, though, that there is another Note engine that we haven't mentioned, and it's Synology's Note Station. Note Station is a lot like Evernote. I mean, so much so that it's probably a little bit embarrassing, but it works really, really well. There is an iOS app that's fantastic. There is no Mac app, and that's the only reason I haven't moved to it. Yeah, you do it all in your web browser, which is fine, but not really the workflow that I want. I want like a dedicated Mac app for it, and it's for that reason that I haven't used it. And I've told the Synology folks this, but you know, they got to do what they got to do. But their iOS app is killer. So anyway, throw that out there too. What do you think, John?
One last one that we became aware of in a recent show. I haven't really used it at all, but it may be worth trying, is Keep.
What's
Google.
Google Keep. Oh, right. Okay.
Which I'm looking at right now. If you go to keep.google.com, brings up something that says Google Keep, and it says take a note, and it looks like there's a icon that lets you insert a graphic or something. So it looks like it's free. Huh. So may want to try that as well.
It's probably free up to your storage limits of your Google account, and then you'd have to buy, you know, more storage on your Google Drive to do all that. Yeah.
Let's look. It's not showing me that.
I mean, yeah, the only downside I would find is that there are smartphone apps. There's Android and iPhone apps, and then if you want to run it on your desktop, there's a Chrome app for it. So you're still in that sort of, you know, web browser bubble on that. But hey, you know, whatevs. So there you go. Very cool. Good question, Phil. A little heavy on the self promotion. I forget what podcast is it. Is he with there? Anyway, no. I like Phil. and the Scared podcast is great. He's got a killer voice, so you know he's got that going for him that totally beats what any of us Americans can do in terms of the accent. He's a radio pro. Love what Phil does. All right. Let's go to David here. Actually, you know what? Let's go through some of these tips that we had from last week's show because it's important to get some of these. We did talk about UPSs last week, and I'm actually going to wait to share all of your UPS related questions and tips until another week goes by, because I know that there will be things that will come in between when I prepped this show and all of that, because it takes you folks a little while sometimes to listen and digest and then come back to us. So we're saving the UPS questions and comments, and there's a ton of great tips. You folks, like, it's awesome. So we will come back to that. It'll just happen next week. But for now, a couple of comments from last week's show. Listener Andrew wrote in and said, on the most recent episode, you were talking about a 27-inch iMac, a user with a 27-inch iMac, a listener, and how he couldn't boot up properly. You offered a lot of suggestions, but did he try target disk mode? If he can do that and then connect it to another computer, he would be able to see if it was indeed the hard drive that was the problem without opening up the iMac. Then he could recover the data and try to wipe the disk and reinstall. Thank you so much for this, Andrew, because that's a great suggestion. Target disk mode essentially turns your computer into a very expensive hard drive case, right? But it can be really, really helpful to troubleshooting exactly this kind of problem. The way that you do it is you start up your computer while holding down the T key, and then that will put your computer into target disk mode, and you can connect FireWire, Thunderbolt 2, USB-C, or Thunderbolt 3, which of course is over the same USB-C port. So there you go. That's a great little suggestion. Thanks, Andrew. Good stuff. Thoughts on that, John, before we...
I've had to use that. And I think last I used it, it will show an icon representing the type of connection. So if it's... I'm not sure if it still does that.
Sure, right.
That's nice, too. The last time I did it, when I had a FireWire connection, it would show the FireWire icon.
Yes, that's right. It'll show the icon of the protocol that you're going to be able to use. That can be helpful. That's right. All right. Let's see. And then we have a thought from Peter about last week's show. And Peter actually did this. I also can go to Evernote and play Peter's thought.
Hi, guys. Listening to MGG646. One quick comment on Dave's ambidextrous trackpad usage. Dude. Anyway, in reference to the discussion of video capture devices, I'm a part-time tech director at a local church, and there's one particular company that we actually use a lot of equipment from, including video capture devices, and that is Blackmagic Design, specifically their Intensity Shuttle. It's a pretty good entry-level device, available in two connection schemes, as far as I know, Thunderbolt and USB 3. Both offer digital and analog inputs. Digital input is HDMI. Analog is composite, both NTSC and PAL. SVO and component. I know that there is pass-through for HDMI. I'm not sure on the analog. You'd have to check that out yourself, but the USB 3.0 version is $200. The Thunderbolt is $240. Hope this helps out. And thanks, guys. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Peter. Great, great suggestion, man. Good stuff. I like it when all that just comes together. I like it when a plan comes together. And yeah, I know I'm crazy with my ambidextrosity. I think that, well, first of all, I'm a drummer, so I've been working both hands my entire life, or at least, you know, since I was like 14 or whatever. I probably have a lot more dexterity in my quote unquote weak hand than most. But I also am left eye dominant, and many times through my life, people have told me that I probably was supposed to be left handed, but just wasn't. So I don't know, whatever. It's fine. I just, you know, when I was like starting trying to leverage my computer skills for money, I did a lot of page layout stuff, and I found that I could type much better one-handed with my right hand than I could with my left hand. And I found myself like using, say, something like PageMaker what else? What did we use? There were all kinds of things anyway, but I would like be bouncing my hand back and forth between the mouse and the keyboard, mouse and the keyboard, mouse and the keyboard. And my left hand was sitting there doing nothing. I'm like, well, that's stupid. So I went home on a Friday afternoon, and I got in front of my Mac SE 30, right? So this should tell you back when this was. And I played Shuffle Puck Cafe that entire weekend with nothing but my left hand. And at first it was like awful. Shuffle Puck Cafe was like air hockey, right? And it was really cool on the SE30 because here was this device with a, you know, the Mac has a mouse. And so it was the perfect thing to, you know, just have this total analog control. And so by playing Shuffle Puck Cafe all weekend with my left hand, I got my dexterity up to the point where I could like go to work and not be totally like flustered. And I moved my mouse over to the left, and I left my right hand on the keyboard and my left hand on the mouse, and that was a machine. It was awesome. So that's where that all started. I don't know. It's crazy. Fun stuff. Right? What was the other page layout app? It began with an F.
Quark Express?
Yeah, no.
FrameMaker?
FrameMaker was for books and stuff. Was it? It must have been Freehand. Yeah. Yeah, it was Freehand that I used. Yeah. Because I never used Quark Express or Illustrator. It was always PageMaker and Freehand were the two that I used together back then. So, anyway. Mac Vader has a question here, so we might as well address that from the chat room. When we were talking about notes, he asked, he says, I was thinking about Yojimbo some time ago. Do you know if it's still in active development? I believe it is. I used Yojimbo for a long time, but because it doesn't really do any sort of syncing, it got very difficult to keep using it. And I moved everything from Yojimbo to Evernote when I did that. And that way I could just have my notes, not only on all my Macs. Yojimbo would sync amongst your Macs, but it would not sync. It didn't have a two-way sync to your iOS devices. And that's where the deal killer was for me. But for a long time, like really long time, I used Yojimbo for our Mac Geek Gab stuff. And then John and I shared it all via Dropbox. Evernote gives us a one-stop shop for that. And it's much better. So there you go. Yeah, good stuff. But, you know, whatever works for you. One last thing, because why not? And we're here. This is a cool stuff found redux, I'll call it. But it's a good one to remember and a nice way to end today's show. Premium listener Jim writes, I'm pretty sure that you have mentioned default folder X or default folder 10 as a must-have app many times over the years. I've been listening to you guys from the beginning, but somehow I never gave it a try. As was once said in a movie my wife watches often, and I have consumed massive quantities of popcorn in front of while sharing quality time with her, big mistake. Big, huge. I started using it on a trial basis a month ago, and I would say that along with Text Expander, Default Folder is the most time-saving utility in my workflow. I'm not sure I could ever go back to living without it. Finding and storing files and locating recent files are now a snap. No more need to go searching for that file I worked on or to sort through my long, several-level deep file system to find the document I worked on yesterday or my go-to folders. I'm a slow learner, and on the off chance that you have another listener or two who hasn't tried Default Folder X, I strongly recommend they take a look. Once in a while, you can teach an old dog a new trick or two. Thanks, Jim. That's you bet, man. I'm like you. I couldn't. Using a Mac without Default Folder feels like using a Mac with mittens. It's just not okay. It's something that desperately needs to be on any computer I use. I think you feel the same way about that, right, John?
It's one of the first things I install on a new machine. Yeah. I think the feature that I use the most is that it keeps a history of the folders that you visited.
Yeah.
And that's very handy.
Yeah.
Because totally. I don't want to navigate the whole folder structure every time I open up a dialog. Or it brings you, often it'll bring you to where you last were. It's smart.
Right. It's smart. Yeah. It is smart. That's very smart. So... cool stuff, folks. Well, we already told you how to email us, but you can call us at 224-888-GEEK and leave a voicemail. John, Geek is
4335.
And you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/group/MacGeekGab is the way to get there. But you could also just go to MacGeekGab.com/Facebook. We'll redirect you there because that makes it a little easier. You can leave us iTunes reviews, and we love your iTunes reviews. In fact, I think I've got one here that we have not read to you yet. So some Mac dude from USA writes, it's a great podcast. It's like always being first in line at the Genius Bar, and I'm amazed at the amount of knowledge I am gaining. We love your comments, folks. So if you visit MacGeekGab.com/iTunes, that will bring you as close as we can get you to leaving us a review. Please do that for us. Would you please? Would you do that? We'd love it. Thank you. Also want to thank CacheFly, CacheFly.com, for providing all the bandwidth to get this show from us to you. And I'd like to thank our sponsors, as I mentioned in the show, Text Expander for Teams at TextExpander.com/geek. Of course, Blue Apron, where you get your first three meals for free at blueapron.com/MGG. And the other sponsors in our podcast marketplace this month include fatcatsoftware.com/MGG, Otherworld Computing at maxsales.com, Barebones Software at barebones.com, GoDaddy at godaddy.com, where coupon code MGG30 saves you and me 30%. And thanks to you for listening. And John, thanks to you for doing the show with me all these years. 12 years almost. It's pretty awesome, man. It's fun. Do you have any thoughts to share with him?
My only thought is that we've been able to do this show for 12 years for one very important reason. And that is because neither of us have gotten caught.